United States is hoping the humanitarian pause between Israel and Hamas can be extended, allowing for more hostages to return home while more aid gets into Gaza.
Israel's interested in getting as many hostages freed as possible, and there are still about 145 hostages in Gaza.
Plus, today is World AIDS Day.
One day in the calendar year that would draw and focus attention of the tragic impact of the HIV and AIDS pandemic.
And U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in the Middle East. Today is Friday, December 1st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Rick Pantaleo in Washington. Israel and Hamas extended their temporary ceasefire for another day on Thursday. Thursday's pact will expire Friday unless Israel and Hamas agree to extend it. I spoke with VOA Middle East correspondent Linda Gradstein, who gives us this update.
On one hand, both Israel and Hamas want it to be extended. Israel is interested in getting as many hostages freed as possible, and there are still about 145 hostages in Gaza, although it's not clear how many Hamas is holding versus other groups and how many of them are even still alive. That said, Hamas is interested in extending the ceasefire because it kind of gives them some breathing room. A lot more international aid is entering. It gives everybody a break. That said, it seems that the criteria that Hamas has set, which is that the only people they will release are women and children, they may be running out of hostages who fit that criteria. There's apparently negotiations on whether Hamas will extend it to include some of the older men it is holding. In addition, Israeli officials have said repeatedly that even if the ceasefire is extended for one day or 2 days, that they intend to go back to fighting in Gaza. And in fact, that seems to be what Secretary of State Antony Blinken is doing here on his fourth trip since October 7th. And it's mainly to talk to Israel about how to avoid killing civilians once the fighting resumes.
What about the ongoing push to get more aid to those who need it during this pause in the hostilities?
Well, there's a lot of aid has been going in to Gaza, you know, hundreds of trucks a day. How it's being distributed is not clear. So the UN is bringing in that aid, taking it to its warehouses, but is it how it's able to distribute it to the population is not clear. The sense that I get from talking to people in Gaza is that aid is getting through flour, sugar, rice, oil, and medicine and water and some cooking oil. But again, Gaza is so poor, and there were 6 weeks of fighting with very little aid getting in, that there's still a shortage of certain things that people need.
Linda, finally, Hamas is saying that those involved in the shooting of three people Thursday at a Jerusalem bus stop were members of its military wing.
Yes, three people were killed, by the way, and several others wounded. And it's the most serious terrorist attack outside of the West Bank and Gaza since the fighting began. And Hamas claimed responsibility, which caused some hardliners in the Israeli government, specifically the National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir, to say, well, if Hamas is violating the ceasefire, then why are we continuing to allow aid and to call for Israel to resume the fighting immediately? I think there is a lot of anger and frustration, and it also just shows that it's impossible to prevent all terrorist attacks. This was a shooting at the entrance to Jerusalem, and the two Hamas gunmen were killed in the shooting, as well as three Israelis. And I think it just kind of increased people's sense of insecurity. And the fact is that I think there is a sense in Israel that Hamas can never be a partner to any kind of future peace agreement.
The United States is hoping the humanitarian pause between Israel and Hamas can be extended, allowing for more hostages to return home while more aid gets into Gaza. But key officials say once Israel decides to go back on the offensive, it will have full U.S. support. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden has more.
Gunmen opening fire at a bus stop in Jerusalem, killing three. Reason enough for the White House to back further Israeli operations against Hamas.
Just another example of the kind of threat that the Israeli people and the Israeli nation are under.
U.S. National Security Council spokesperson John Kirby.
They'll continue to find support from the United States in terms of the tools and capabilities, the weapon systems that they need.
But while Kirby emphasizes that Israel has both a right and a responsibility to target Hamas, even in southern Gaza, he says Israel must do more to protect Palestinian civilians.
We do not support a move to the south unless or until they have adequately accounted for the protection of innocent human life, civilian life.
Pentagon spokesperson Sabrina Singh says Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin has made that clear in repeated calls with his Israeli counterpart. But she adds, ensuring high civilian casualties is part of Hamas's plan.
Hamas is a terrorist organization that embeds deeply within civilian infrastructure and uses civilians as a way of shielding their operations.
Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in the Middle East, holding talks Thursday with Israeli and Palestinian officials and coming out with an unusually blunt message to Israel about the next phase of its war against Hamas. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken was back in Israel for the fourth time since the October 7th terrorist attack by Hamas, pushing to have the truce with Hamas extended again, and calling in unusually frank language for protections for Palestinian civilians whenever fighting resumes.
We discussed the details of Israel's ongoing planning, and I underscored the imperative of the United States that the massive loss of civilian life and displacement of the scale that we saw in northern Gaza not be repeated in the south. As I told the Prime Minister, intent matters, but so does the result.
Israeli media reported that behind closed doors, Blinken told the Israeli War Cabinet that they likely have weeks, not months, to prosecute the war against Hamas. Asked if the U.S. had suggested a time limit on the war, Blinken did not answer directly. Reiterating American support for Israel's right to defend itself, but again saying it is imperative that Palestinian civilians and their infrastructure not be targeted during the next phase. One veteran analyst told VOA he had fully expected Blinken to deliver a firm message from U.S. President Joe Biden to Israeli leaders amid the mounting pressure caused by the reported deaths of more than 15,000 Palestinians in Gaza in Israeli attacks. Lawrence Korb is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, a former Assistant Secretary of Defense, and a retired Navy captain. He spoke to VOA via Zoom.
If and when Israel resumes fighting, do not use the same tactics that you used the first time, where you worried more about getting Hamas than killing innocent civilians, particularly if you decide to bomb in the south.
Another expert told VOA that there is a lot of tension behind the scenes between top U.S. and Israeli officials over the protection of Palestinian civilians and the future of Gaza and the West Bank. Sarah Yeager is Washington Director of Human Rights Watch. She spoke to VOA via Zoom.
And so this is a really interesting moment for the United States government. What is it going to do? Is it going to reassess its relationship with Israel and its you know, unconditional military support? Or is it going to get a little bit tougher and put that military support on the table?
Some Democratic lawmakers have called on Israel to use restraint and not bomb heavily populated areas in Gaza, saying the U.S. could put conditions on its military aid. Earlier Thursday, Blinken arrived in an armored convoy in Ramallah for talks with Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas. Abbas stressed the unity of Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza and called for a lasting ceasefire. Cindy Sain, VOA News.
We're also following these other stories from around the world. The OPEC oil cartel and allied producers have made another big swipe at propping up lagging crude prices. The OPEC plus oil ministers came out of an online meeting Thursday with more than 2 million barrels a day in voluntary cuts through the first 3 months of next year. A defiant U.S. Representative, George Santos, is refusing to resign and warning colleagues that his expulsion from Congress before being convicted in a court of law would establish a precedent that is going to be the undoing of a lot of members of this body. Three people speaking to Reuters say China's Evergrande Group, the world's most indebted property developer, is seeking to avert a potentially imminent liquidation with a last-minute debt restructuring proposal. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Rick Pantaleo. The UN Climate Summit clinched an early victory Thursday with delegates adopting a new fund to help poor nations cope with the costly climate disasters. COP28 President Sultan Al-Jaber said the decision sent a positive signal of momentum to the world and to our work here in Dubai. Reuters' Rachel Judah has more.
The UN Climate Summit clinched an early victory on Thursday, with delegates adopting a new fund to help vulnerable nations cope with the cost of climate-driven disasters. The deal was adopted following the COP28 opening ceremony in Dubai and already follows many months of negotiations. But some groups were cautious, noting there were still unresolved issues, including how the fund would be financed in the future. The United Arab Emirates will contribute $100 million to the pot, along with other countries contributing a total of just over $300 million. Germany pledged $100 million and the United States $17.5 million, with hopes the amount would build to a substantial sum. The early breakthrough on the damage fund, which poorer nations have demanded for years, could help grease the wheels for further compromises. Earlier in the day, COP28 President Sultan Al-Jaber, who is also the CEO of the UAE's National Oil Company, opened the summit urging countries and fossil fuel companies to work together to meet global climate goals. Al-Jaber aimed to strike a conciliatory tone following months of criticism over his appointment as the head of COP28.
Let history reflect the fact that this is the presidency that made a bold choice to proactively engage with oil and gas companies. We had many hard discussions. Let me tell you, that wasn't easy. But today, many of these companies are committing to zero methane emissions by 2030 for the first time. And now, many national oil companies have adopted net zero 2050 targets for the first time. And I'm grateful that they have stepped up to join this game-changing journey. But I must say, it is not enough. And I know that they can do much more.
Over the next 2 weeks, governments will also debate whether to agree for the first time to phase out the use of CO2 emitting coal, oil and gas globally, the main source of emissions. Also on the agenda is what's known as the global stocktake. This is when countries assess their progress in meeting global climate goals, the main one being the Paris Agreement goal of limiting global warming to well below 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit or 2 degrees Celsius.
That was Rachel Judah of Reuters. Nigerian authorities say national defense, internal security, and economic stability are a priority of the 2024 budget that President Bola Tinubu delivered to lawmakers on Wednesday. Timothy Obiju reports from Abuja.
Nigerian President Bola Tinubu presented his $35 billion 2024 federal budget to lawmakers at a joint session of the National Assembly. Under the new budget, authorities allocated about $4 billion or 12% of the total budget to defense and security, the largest single allocation to any sector. In his first budget speech since coming to office, Tinubu told lawmakers that security is important to safeguard lives, property, and investments across the country. Tinubu said he will overhaul Nigeria's internal security architecture to boost performance operations and achieve better results. But experts say Nigerian authorities have consistently increased military spending in recent years without making Nigerians safer and more secure. Kabiru Adamu is an analyst for consulting firm Beacon Security in Abuja.
In the 2023 budget, security enjoyed the largest allocation, and we're seeing the same thing in this current budget draft, but the budget that was submitted to the National Assembly. There is, I think, almost about 30-40% increase in the provision for, but unfortunately, we haven't seen remarkable improvement in the provision of security to equate this attention that government is given in terms of funding. So what is the challenge? I think it has to do with accountability and monitoring the performance of the security sector.
Africa's largest economy faces many security problems, including a 14-year Islamist insurgency in the northeast, separatist violence in the south, often deadly clashes between pastoralists and farmers, and proliferation of kidnap-for-ransom gangs in the northwest and central regions. Tinubu, who embarked on bold economic reforms, including the scrapping of fuel subsidies and removal of foreign exchange restrictions, promised to fix security problems if elected. But this week, local residents in northwest Zamfara State said they are still reeling after armed gangs last Friday attacked their villages and kidnapped more than 100 residents. The gangs are demanding about $236,000 for the captives' freedom. Security analyst Senator Irebu says corruption is the reason the increased military spending is not yielding results.
Do they have the capacity, all these agencies, MDA, to actually maximize this budget, the amount? Then the issue of corruption, how this money expended, how is it being disbursed? Is it rightly used for what it's supposed to use? Then the issue of approach, then the issue of political will and interest of conflict matchups.
In October, President Tinubu signed what he called performance bond with cabinet members. The agreement allows authorities to review the performance of serving officials and hold those underperforming accountable. But Adamu says he's worried about one thing.
What we are hoping is that performance bond would be measured in a manner, implemented rather in a manner that we will see an improvement in security. Security personnel do not willingly subject themselves to the civilian administration. I worry a little bit.
Meanwhile, Nigerian authorities predict the economy will grow by 3.76% next year, well above the global average. In recent weeks, the president has been meeting with foreign officials and business leaders with the aim of attracting more investments to Nigeria. In one notable deal, Saudi Arabia agreed to rehabilitate Nigeria's non-functioning oil refineries. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Today marks the 35th World AIDS Day. It is a global movement to unite people in the fight against HIV and AIDS. I spoke with Vinay Sadana, director of the UNAIDS U.S. Liaison Office in Washington. I asked him about the purpose of World AIDS Day and if there is any special reason it's marked on December 1st.
It has been marked on December 1st for 35 years in a row, beginning in 1988 as a date that was originally conceived of by the World Health Organization and the international community as one day in the calendar year that would draw and focus attention of the tragic impact of the HIV and AIDS pandemic around the world, the 1st of December, but also as a call for solidarity and support for the tens of millions of people that are living with HIV and to really commit additional attention and resources for the fight against HIV and AIDS in every country and in every community.
Of course, there is still confusion after all these years about how HIV/AIDS is transmitted.
HIV, it's very clear, is a virus that can be spread through the exchange of bodily fluids from a person who's infected with HIV, and specifically through the exchange of blood, breast, milk, semen, and vaginal fluids. But it's equally important to understand how HIV is not transmitted. It's not spreaded by hugs or kisses. It's not spreaded by handshakes. It's not spread by sharing of food. It can be spread from mother to child or from mother to her unborn baby, but treatment is now available and prevention is now available to really reduce the likelihood of so-called mother-to-child transmission of HIV to zero.
And I know research continues since the 1980s. Are there any promising treatments or prevention techniques still being developed?
The really life-changing development in HIV treatment came in 1996 with the advent of highly active antiretroviral treatment for people infected with and diagnosed with HIV infection. So-called HART, or the cocktail combination therapy of HIV medications, has now been made very easily accessible, very simplified, safe, minimizes side effects, and it's most importantly been demonstrated in millions of people around the world every day who are taking these medications, that people living with HIV can live full, happy, safe lives, not be concerned about progressing from HIV infection to AIDS, and not be concerned about the transmission of HIV from them to their partner. Because when someone is on antiretroviral treatment and the treatment is functioning effectively, they reach undetectable levels of HIV in their system. Not new. This has been known since 1996, but the tremendous benefits of HIV treatment as a prevention tool, as well as a tool for combating stigma and discrimination, that people living with HIV, and there are 39 million people living with HIV around the world, can live a full life, including a full sexual life, without having to worry about stigma and discrimination related to their HIV status. If they are aware of their HIV status, if they're on effective antiretroviral treatment, if they've reached undetectable viral loads, they can really celebrate what we call U equals U, or undetectable equals untransmittable. Some of the more innovative and more recent ones is pre-exposure prophylaxis. It's the use of antiretroviral medication as a prevention tool. And if used properly and regularly, it can significantly minimize, almost eliminate the likelihood of HIV transmission and prevent someone who is HIV negative from getting HIV in the first place. So it's a very innovative tool. It's now been available for several years in what we would call high-income countries or Western countries. And now with the support of PEPFAR, the U.S. President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, support from the Global Fund, support from the Joint United Nations Program on HIV and AIDS, UNAIDS, this life-saving HIV prevention tool called PrEP is now being rapidly expanded to people who are most in need of HIV prevention in low- and middle-income countries.
That was Vinay Saldana, Director of the UNAIDS U.S. Liaison Office in Washington. And this has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. Until next time, this is Rick Pantaleo in Washington, wishing you a great weekend, good health, and good news tomorrow.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
December 1st marks the 35th World AIDS Day. This year is the 20th anniversary of the launch of PEPFAR, the United States President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. Ambassador-at-Large John Nkengasong is U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator and Senior Bureau Official for Health Security and Diplomacy at the U.S. Department of State. He said that when PEPFAR was created, the life expectancy in many countries in Africa had dropped significantly. Some countries were heading towards extinction.
It was, in my view, a greatest act of solidarity and expression of our values that the American people launched to save a whole continent that was going through and facing tremendous challenges there.
The theme of this year's World AIDS Day is Remember and Commit.
Because of the success that PEPFAR and other programs like the Global Fund have achieved, people are beginning to not remember how it used to look like. Whether you're seeing a baby in Botswana that is born free of HIV infection, or an HIV-infected woman who has benefited from treatment and is living a normal life and have now children born free of HIV, that is remarkable. That is the story that must be told.
However, the gains made in treating people infected with HIV/AIDS are fragile. If a patient stops receiving treatment, the virus returns in just 5 weeks.
So it's so important to maintain a political engagement, political leadership in maintaining the HIV programs so that we can bring HIV/AIDS to an end by the year 2030 as a public health threat.
By prioritizing accessible healthcare, prevention efforts, research and innovation, the U.S. aims to work with partners to meet UNA's 95-95-95 goal. The goal calls for 95% of those living with HIV to know their status, 95% of those who know their status to be on treatment, and 95% of those on treatment to be virally suppressed. The U.S. government has been globally recognized in the fight against HIV, noted Ambassador Nkengasong. It's one of those areas in our leadership in global health that is known globally, and I think we cannot relent from that.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.